episode 427 of Inside Education, the podcast for educators who are interested in teaching. I'm Sean Delaney, a primary teacher and teacher educator. I've written a book about teaching called Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, which was published by Routledge and is now available as an audiobook. I know it's been a while since a new podcast episode has dropped, but I do have plans to bring you several more throughout 2024. Today's episode is going to be of particular interest to anyone involved in teacher education, because I'm interviewing someone who has spent 55 years as a professional educator. As always, you can follow me on Twitter, or X, where I use the handle @InsideEd, and I love to receive feedback or suggestions by email to InsideEducationPodcast@yahoo.com. All previous episodes of Inside Education are available for listening or downloading if you go to my website, seandelaney.com, and click on the Podcasts tab. The guest on today's podcast is Professor Etta Hollins from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where she is Professor Emerita in the Division of Teacher Education and Curriculum Studies. Among the several books she has published is Rethinking Teacher Preparation Program Design, which was published by Routledge in 2021 and was co-authored with Connor Warner. She has received multiple awards for her work, and her research encompasses teaching and teacher preparation for diverse and underserviced students in primary and secondary schools, and the design and redesign of pre-service teacher preparation and professional development. I met up with her at the annual meeting of the Association of Teacher Educators, which took place at the end of March in Anaheim, California, where she gave the research keynote address. During our interview, Professor Hollins refers to synthetic phonics a few times. A contrast is often made between analytic and synthetic phonics. Analytic phonics involves combining phonics approaches with a substantial whole word element. With synthetic phonics, children learn to decode unfamiliar words by blending letter sounds. You'll like this podcast if you are interested in how teachers learn to teach and how teacher education can be improved. You'll also like it if you believe in a constructivist approach and you appreciate the work of John Dewey. The podcast will appeal to anyone who believes in the power of teaching to transform lives and communities, especially in areas that have been disadvantaged socially or economically. How do you think teachers learn to teach? Many of us might believe that how we learned is the only way, but models of teacher education vary substantially. For example, in Norway, it takes 5 years and a master's qualification to become a teacher, whereas in the United Kingdom, you can become a teacher in as little as 9 months. When I met up with Professor Etta Hollins, I first asked her how she believes student teachers learn to teach.
I think that the way student teachers learn to teach is through, it's a constructivist perspective. So how they learn to teach is through observation, the application of academic knowledge to practice, and analyzing that practice and the responses of their students to that practice, and then doing a reflection on, if they were the person engaging, doing a reflection on their own thinking in preparation for facilitating that learning, you know, and trying to understand whether their preparation was adequate, whether their performance in terms of facilitation was adequate for the students as they're reflecting on how they engaged in facilitating that learning. And this brings them also to understanding differences in how individuals learn as they're making their observation and their reflection on it. So they're developing a habit of mind that would allow them to be really good observers. I think observation is really the key to good teaching practice, as you're observing how students are responding, as you're reflecting on what your intentions were. I think that's what gets us to expertise.
From what you've said there, it sounds as if you see student teachers having contact with young children from very early on in their teacher preparation. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. In my conceptualization, almost everything in a teacher preparation program is observable, or can be analyzed in practice, or can be applied to practice. So in order for candidates to really understand this, they need to begin doing this kind of observation with their very first courses in teacher education, whether those courses are foundational courses, you know, as in the history of education, or whether they are theories of learning or theories or methods of practice. They need to be always observing, documenting, analyzing, etc. And sometimes for those of us in teacher education, we don't really see that application. But no matter who you're studying, if you, you know, you go back to Jerome Bruner or John Dewey, you can actually go into schools and you can see their influence on the curriculum, you know, on the theory. You can actually infer it from the practice itself or from the text materials that the teachers are using.
When you look in a classroom, there's so much going on that for a novice, it must be very, very difficult to focus. So how do you scaffold beginning student teachers' observation of what's happening in a classroom?
So in my practice, there's something that I call directed observation. So if you're studying learning theory, for example, you're going in to observe learning theory. And that sort of narrows your focus, so you're not looking at the entire thing. Actually, when I go to classrooms to observe, you know, like recently I went to Peru and spent a lot of time looking in classrooms to see how the classrooms were actually working. Well, the first thing I was looking for was the theory that undergirded it and how the teachers understood and applied that theory as I engaged with them in conversation. I observed how the children were processing what was being presented to them, right? So my first focus was really on the theory.
So if we take that a step further and the children in the class are learning to read, can you say how you would apply your knowledge of learning theory to help novices observe the children learning to read?
So, you know, like I have a preference for kind of constructivism, but there's also a cognitivism that interplays as a subcomponent even of the constructivism. So if I'm talking about really early literacy, very early literacy, I'm going to connect learning to read with how children learn to speak. So I'm not going for synthetic phonics or something like that. What I'm really going for is repetition of sounds in words in reading, right? So I would start out with something like, there's a book called Brown Bear, Brown Bear, that repeats syllables repeatedly. And so I'm going to start with that with the children so that they sort of get the rhythm of the connection between the print and the language, the spoken language. And as they're doing that, you know, they will start to be able to pretty much recite the book. But then in order for them to understand words, I'm going to start to show them words on a flashcard. As you were saying brown bear, I'm going to show you bear. And we can just repeat the word bear as you're reading, right? Instead of just reading it continuously, you'll now say brown bear, but you'll say bear, bear. And you'll start to associate this word that I'm holding in my hand with the word that's on the page, so you can now begin to separate that out. I know that's a lot of detail, but...
No, that's very helpful. And what I'm wondering is, that's very context specific.
Yes.
So how do you help the student teachers then to extrapolate from that observation to the broader experience of learning to read and applying that in other contexts, that they don't just replicate that very specific example that they've observed?
Well, first of all, for me, the next question is how to move the child from this way that I'm introducing reading to a high level of reading. And actually, it's going to be easier than you think, because what I'm going to do is progressively increase the complexity of the reading and get the child less dependent on the kind of repetition of syllables that I start out with. So they'll develop a broader sight vocabulary. And with that sight vocabulary, the children are going to learn how syllables are embedded in word patterns, etc. So they'll be looking for the familiar pattern. So what the, and of course I'm taking comprehension along with it, because in my theoretical perspective of learning to read, if you keep the child's ability to read with the same fluency level as the child's ability to speak, then we're going to bring comprehension along with familiar text. And so what I'm doing with the student teacher who might be observing this is the student teacher is learning some basic principles for the teaching of reading that can be transferred and applied in different situations. You know, like this whole idea of knowledge being cumulative and increasingly complex, you know, adding as the child is ready to move forward is a basic principle of learning to read. Keeping fluency at a speaking level so that comprehension progresses as you are engaging the child in familiar text is also a principle that they're learning that can be applied whether you're doing reading or mathematics.
So if you have, say, a class of student teachers and they're all observing different things in classrooms, how do you help them make sense of that from a theoretical or what you would say, I think, an academic point of view after their observation? Or, you know, how is that relationship between applying the academic side of things to what multiple different students are seeing in practice?
Okay, so what I'm saying is that there are like a number of epistemic practices in which I am engaged as the person facilitating candidates learning as they're having clinical experiences, right? And, you know, like the first one is focused inquiry. Focused inquiry means that we're studying something specific that you're going to be able to observe or apply in a classroom. So no matter which classrooms that they're looking in, the focused inquiry is guiding them to pay attention to a certain thing through what we now call directed observation. So they may be observing different implementations of the same thing, but they are what they're observing is connected to the same big idea. So when we start to have the conversation in the classroom to kind of debrief that, what is happening is just a tremendous expansion of understanding of the possibilities and the different ways that this can be observed and experienced. And so it makes for a very rich learning experience.
I'd like now to move to another area, which moving out from the individual student teacher learning to teach to the teacher education program. And you've a book out on that relatively recently. But one of the things that in Ireland we do is schools engage in what's called a school self-evaluation process. And given the amount of work that you have said that goes into revising or redesigning a teacher education program, how does a program decide when it's necessary to redesign it? You know, how do you make the decision that, no, it's actually working well as it is, or no, this program needs to be redesigned?
Well, sometimes not a whole program needs to be redesigned, sometimes aspects. But how you determine that is by outcomes and impact. And so the best way to look at outcomes and impact is through feedback from program graduates and feedback from people who employ your graduates or people who engage the field experiences as well, okay? You have to be open to ask the right questions and to accept the feedback. And like one of the areas I think that we sometimes neglect is when we talk about impact is how our candidates are viewed by their peers when they're employed. You know, do their peers trust the knowledge of the graduates? And by that, we can talk about how they consult with the candidates or how the candidates feel that what it is that they're saying in meetings, et cetera, has some kind of an influence. So we're not necessarily preparing candidates to directly engage in activism in the transformation of schools, but we are preparing them to be active participants in the process of schooling. And so they would naturally have certain kinds of questions that they would be asking about practices and protocols in the school just to gain an understanding. But because they're asking those questions, it will have an influence on the thought processes of the people who are explaining those processes. And it has like an impact. So we're looking for that level of impact. We're also looking for how the school evaluates, how school leaders evaluate the performance of our graduates. We want to listen to that very carefully. It's not that we always agree with how they do it, but when we're asking the question, we're also informing the perception. So it's a really a complex thing if we really think that through in terms of how we're impacting that. So we gather all of these data, and we look at the data and our program to see where we might need to make changes in order to improve our impact or the outcomes that our candidates are getting with their students.
So is that kind of questioning of a teacher education program, is that something that is continuous?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it's continuous. It depends on, you know, like how often do you want to get this feedback, or how much demand do you want to place on practicing educators' time to complete surveys, et cetera, right? It also says something about how you need to construct your survey in order to make it convenient for people to answer, yet give you the information that you actually need. So in some cases, some institutions do annual surveys, not necessarily of the same people all the time, but they do annual surveys. Some people do them every couple of years. And so it depends on how often you want to get that feedback. But the thing that I think we really have to keep in mind in pre-service teacher ed is that we are responsible for preparing the people who facilitate learning for the children. And so if the children are not learning to read well in a certain school or school district, whether it's a low income or an upper income, we need to be concerned about that, because we need to be concerned about whether or not we are actually preparing candidates who can go into those environments and meet the needs of those children and facilitate their learning to high levels.
How can field experiences, or what we call in Ireland school placements, how can they, those experiences, be improved for student teachers?
I'm not sure about Ireland, because I haven't really looked at that system. But my general response to the improvement of the whole clinical experience is influenced by the trustworthiness of the knowledge base and the application of the knowledge base to practice in the clinical experience. Okay? So if I am the person responsible for one or more courses in the methods of teaching reading, especially early literacy, maybe even mid-level literacy, if I'm the person responsible for that, and my observation instruments when I go into the schools to look actually check on whether the student teachers are implementing the practice from the course to the classroom. So they will have multiple to select from, right? And if their selection seems appropriate, I'm checking to see if their selection seems appropriate for the children that they're teaching. And if they're able to make adjustments for the children who are outliers, that's what I'm checking for. If my instruction has been adequate in the classroom at the university, then I'm able to see the application. Now I have to check to see if my program got it right, if the course got it right, because the question is whether or not those practices have the appropriate outcomes.
So then the person who is observing the student on the field placement plays a critical role, and they need to know what the student has been taught how to do in the classroom.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the instrument that you're using to collect the data has to reflect the kind of information collection that I'm talking about.
Does that mean it needs to be subject-specific, or can a generic instrument work for that? In other words, do you need one for mathematics, one for observing a music lesson, one for observing a physical education lesson, or will a generic instrument be appropriate?
I mean, certainly you could use, I mean, I think I could design, actually I have designed generic instruments, but if we really want to get at reading and mathematics, I think we need a more precise information for that data collection in those critical areas. I don't think that that would apply to, you know, social studies or those other subjects, because once we have the reading and the math really worked out, those are really basic. That's really basic. So we don't want there to be weaknesses in those areas. And as the child progresses in reading, then they get to discipline-specific literacy, which will help them with these other disciplines through the reading itself, through the teaching of reading itself. And that's why these things become so important. The reading and the math become absolutely critical.
That makes sense. How do you decide then, you know, coming towards the end of a student teacher's program, how do you decide if they're ready to take on independent responsibility for a class? In other words, if they're ready to graduate from the program? Because one of the things you mentioned yesterday is the importance of consistency among graduates. So where do you draw the line that this person is ready to go and be an ambassador for our program, but more importantly, to be somebody who's competent to have independent responsibility for their class?
Well, when they can consistently apply academic knowledge to practice and make adjustments as needed for differences among children, and get the learning outcomes that are expected for the child for the age, grade level, and subject matter, that's when they're ready.
That's a lot for a novice to be able to do.
Oh, but we can get them to do it. You know, we have. You know, in some of the programs where we've done the redesign, we've actually gone out to observe that, whether they can do that or not. And what is so interesting about doing that is how excited the students are, because they now feel competent and ready to be able to go into a classroom and teach, maybe a little overconfident.
So if that is your judgment, then should the entire assessment of a student's achievement in a teacher education course, an initial teacher education course, should that be based on the practicum, or is there any role for projects or examinations on the academic side of what the student will have learned?
Well, what I'm suggesting is an ongoing assessment of the academic side, because we're talking about the application of academic knowledge to practice. That's an ongoing assessment. So we don't have to worry about that. And in addition to that, we have an ongoing performance assessment. So we have all the data we need in order to determine the student teacher's readiness for independent practice.
So really, you're saying that all assessment is based on the practicum, is that right?
Yes. Yes. Because it's application of academic knowledge to practice. So if you really understand, the student-teacher can demonstrate an understanding of learning theory, whether we're talking about cognitivism, constructivism, or some other thing, they demonstrate that in their observations first, right? In their observations in classrooms, which is a part of the clinical experience, you know. Then later, they demonstrate their understanding when they begin to plan lessons, because they can explain to us, you know, the kind of theory that they're using to understand student learning as they're planning that. They're also explaining what they understand about child or adolescent growth and development while they're planning that lesson. So everything is there in the clinical experience. All the knowledge application is right there.
But is that not too context specific? So, for example, if you're in, say, what you would call an urban school, what we would call a school serving an area of disadvantage, and if a student's entire experience of practicum is in that kind of a setting, in an urban setting, then they may not be as good at applying their knowledge if they were to be teaching in a rural setting or in a more privileged, affluent background area.
I don't think that's true. The reason why I don't think that's true is because what we're doing is paying attention to children's responses to the experiences that are provided. And so as we're paying attention to those experiences and adapting the pedagogy based on those responses, that is a habit of mind that transfers to any place you're teaching, to any grade level. You know, like in my work, it even transfers to my practice with adults. You know, that's what the facilitation of the transformation of the teacher preparation program is about. I'm trying to understand who it is that I'm working with in terms of what they understand, what they know, what they value, how they interact, how they're positioned within the faculty. I'm trying to understand all of those things because I'm trying to create a teamwork. I'm trying to draw everybody in. I'm trying to bring the best of everybody out. That's the same thing that the teachers are doing in the classroom. So that transfers to my work as a facilitator in the transformation of a pre-service teacher preparation program. That's why we have less resistance. It's because of the way that I'm trying to work that. So everybody feels respected. Nobody's thinking that I'm coming with an agenda other than to get the best outcome that we can get as a collective body.
You've written a book about the transformation of schools and communities that have been disadvantaged socially and economically, or what you would call urban schools. To what extent is it possible for teachers to transform such settings?
I think that's a really interesting question, and it is also a part of the reason for writing the book. Because sometimes, you know, if we just prepare people to go in and apply academic knowledge to practice, they may not think so deeply about the purpose. You know, why am I teaching? How will the children benefit personally in their lives? How will communities be shaped by what I'm doing? And so that book helps with that kind of thing. It's the bigger purpose for the work that we do. And as we are dealing with the bigger purpose, you know, we can start to see that kind of transformation, believe it or not. It sounds idealistic, but, you know, like I sometimes have, you know, like some really wonderful experiences from some of the students that I taught in K-12 schools who really do surprise me by saying, you know, when I was in seventh grade, you taught us to do blah, blah. And so now he's talking about how that has influenced his life and his life decisions, et cetera. And so, you know, like, because I taught history in middle school, you know, that's really about that whole how you position yourself in the world, how you understand historical settings, how you learn to inquire as a historian, you know, how you learn about perspective taking. you know, like, that sounds complex, but that's what I was doing in middle school. And then you see the children begin to, even as teenagers and adults, start to take a different kind of social responsibility. And so that's the change that teachers can bring about, is that kind of thing. And you see it in different places. We don't do it so much in the U.S. the way we used to in terms of teaching values. But when I was visiting in Peru, it was really a really central part of what they were doing at all levels, at all social class levels. They were teaching a set of values that should move the society forward.
And do you think that kind of transformation of schools and communities by teachers, is that something that every teacher can do, or is it really something for the exceptional teachers?
Every teacher, whether they do it intentionally or not, influences children's perception, their relationships, their values, and who they become. Every teacher influences that. Now, I would think that it might be in our best interest as a profession if teachers were aware that they were doing that and that they're doing it more intentionally.
And have you seen examples of that, either in a positive or a negative sense?
Here in the United States, the negative is clearly documentable. It's documentable in school shootings. And so most of us don't want to talk about the origin of the need for a child to grow up and come back and shoot up the school. But if we listen to what the children are saying to us, when they are interviewed by news reporters, when they talk about that child that came back and shot up the school, it's always a child who was isolated, excluded by their peers. That can be directly influenced by teachers, and they should be able to do it from their courses in child growth and development. They should be able to do it from their courses in adolescent development to help that child find a place of comfort in the school, help that child to build relationships with peers, help peers to be more accepting of difference. And those are not difficult things to do. So that's the negative side. But on the positive side, you can go to schools like Bank Street in New York and you can watch them do that. It's observable in the school. You know, you can see every child feeling comfortable. You can see when a child has come into that school anew and doesn't understand how to build relationships. You can see the other children helping that child build relationships. You can see the teacher helping that child. So they're doing that very consciously, and they're being very successful at doing it.
And is that the leadership of the principal that is infiltrating into the work of the teachers, or is it something that a teacher can take autonomy for?
It's John Dewey. It goes back to John Dewey. That's a school founded by John Dewey. And, you know, like, I made it my business to visit all of the schools. There were only like five or six of them, started by John Dewey or his students in the United States. I visited those. And I even had the good fortune of visiting a school started by John Dewey in Taiwan. And in these schools, you can see John Dewey's signature. Today, you can still see his signature.
How?
Okay, so when John Dewey founded the school, that idea, it was about the study of children and how you make sense of children in terms of bringing children together, that whole child growth and development thing, that whole self-regulation thing that came later. All of that is built into John Dewey's conceptualization of how learning takes place. His conceptualization, believe it or not, of diversity, of all of those issues, they're combined in those schools, and they are just marvelous places to go to observe, like the implementation of constructivism, for example. And the people can all talk about it. Now, how has that been maintained? It's been maintained because of a sense of clarity, a sense of commitment to John Dewey's principles. it's been a sense of commitment to interviewing teachers to find out if they are receptive to that idea. And that's a part of their hiring practice. You know, like I really got into that John Dewey School thing deeply to try to understand, you know, for 115 years, why those schools are still so successful.
So if you were hiring a teacher for that kind of a school, what would be the key question you'd ask the teacher?
One of the key questions I would ask the teacher is how they understand student learning. How do you understand that? You know, like at the Bank Street School, in terms of literacy, they do something they call informational reading. And so that's very different from the synthetic phonics or the systematic phonics for initial reading. And if you watch the development of those children in reading, it's very fast. And if you look at the school, the lab school in Chicago, which is also one of John Dewey's places, you will see that they pride themselves in taking kids from low-income environments, and they get the same kind of outcomes as the one at Bank Street.
You've written a book about culture in school learning. What does culture mean in this context?
Well, culture influences cognition, values, and practices with which children are familiar. And the cognition for young children, and probably for older children as well, but more broadly, is a matter of an apprenticeship. You know, a child learns to think through the same way that they learn language, right? And they're learning it from caregivers early on. And so you have to be able to understand how that child's cognition is working. And that's a cultural origin. And so you can begin to sort of like look at children, listen to children in terms of how they're thinking, and you can begin to sort of group kids and then anticipate what they know, how they know it, and where some gaps may be that you need to fill in order to teach certain things. So culture becomes a really important place of understanding. And you think about it, when you think about it more broadly, it also becomes a way of understanding pre-service teachers. And I'll give you a really detailed example, maybe. When I was teaching at one university in California, one of the things that I noticed about my candidates, because I also practice the observation that I teach my candidates to do. So one of the things that I noticed about the candidates as I was teaching about diversity, right, was that for anything that I would try to say or that they would read, they had an N of one that would contradict it. Then I observed that they trusted only their own personal experiences. Nothing academic really mattered. So what that meant to me was that that was a habit of mind that they had gained through their kind of cultural socialization, right? So in order for me to be able to better prepare them to be teachers, I had to move them past that, right? So I had to give them an experience that would enable them to understand difference, to be able to see it. So I gave them an experience where they worked in a group of five, and each member of the group, they had to decide what ethnic group they were going to study. And each member had to interview 10 high school students or recent graduates about their experiences in elementary schools, and I gave them like five questions they needed to ask these people. They couldn't go onto a school campus. You know, they had to meet them in the YMCA, at the shopping mall or someplace, and I gave them a way to be able to initiate a conversation. So long story short, they all did this. They analyzed their data. They wrote a collaborative paper. Each person brought five references to the table. and then they made a presentation to the class. That was such a powerful experience to them, for them, because they actually were able to see an N of 50 that showed a pattern of experiences for a particular ethnic group that differed from their own experiences significantly. And now they were ready to help my colleagues understand diversity. When they would go into other classes, they would say, no, 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 that's not correct. My data and evidence shows X.
That's really interesting. And were you afraid that there was a risk there that they might end up stereotyping the different ethnic groups?
No, because each group had a particular ethnic group. When that was the reason for the class presentation. So they could see across ethnic groups, they could see difference. So my whole point was to teach how to recognize these differences. And ultimately what we're getting to is how to deal with these differences when you recognize them in your classroom and you're trying to teach reading or math or history.
But you could also have differences within ethnic groups, right?
Of course you can, and they saw that. But that's why they had 10. They were interviewing 10, right?
Okay.
So they were seeing difference. I mean, my point was difference, right?
Yeah.
But there were also ethnic group patterns.
We're coming near the end, Professor Hollins. I have a few just general questions that I ask all guests. And one is there a teacher who had a significant impact on you?
Are we talking K-12 or are we talking...
However you want to interpret it.
Well, in my high school, the teacher who had the greatest influence on me was actually my ethics teacher. He was wonderful. I mean, the way that he understood life, the way he helped us look at life and responsibility for ourselves, our families, and living in a democratic society, and taking action, you know, and all of the importance of that. Like, I still live by those principles from that ethics class. You know, the second person that had the biggest influence on me was my political science teacher in college, in undergraduate school. You know, he reminded us that every contact we have, every individual we're talking with, all of that is political. And then he taught us how to understand that, how to make sense of that, how to interact with that. Before we got to the point of actually dealing with real political kinds of issues.
What is school for, or what are schools for?
At a fundamental level, schools are about the development of the mind, the family, the society, etc. But begins with the development of the mind and cognition, expanding what we know, understand, and can learn.
Who or what inspires you?
I think what inspires me is the awesome responsibility of being a professional educator. I mean, it's an awesome responsibility because we're responsible for that thing I just said, that whole development of cognition, of understanding among people, of how you access knowledge, what knowledge and what knowledge sources you trust. You know, that's an awesome responsibility. And that keeps me at the work, you know, like, you know, I probably have worked in the field more than 90% of the people because I spent 55 years as an educator. You know, that's more than most people in education now are old.
And what is your vision of an educated person?
That is a person who, first of all, understands the limits of their own knowledge and who is always open to checking the validity of the knowledge that they do have and who can listen to other people, hear what they are saying, see what they're doing, and learn from it.
And finally, I have a question for you. And what I'm really looking for here is a book recommendation for teachers. So it might be a book that had an influence on you. It might be a book you really like, or it might be just a book that you would recommend for somebody just getting into teaching you know, just is there any book you'd recommend teachers to read?
You're asking about a single book. See, that's always really, really difficult. So what I would say is, you know, like I'm really tempted to say, study John Dewey, okay? Whatever John Dewey wrote, read it, okay? That's what I'm tempted to say, okay? Because there's a lot there. But I think what I would say is try to understand deeply a particular theoretical perspective on learning. Try to really understand it, whether it's cognitivism or constructivism or, you know, emotional intelligence. Try to really get in there and really understand how it's working. It is really difficult to develop a coherent approach to teaching and learning without a deep understanding of how it works.
Professor Hollins, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for talking to me today.
Sure, sure. It's my pleasure.
And that was Professor Etta Hollins suggesting that a way to become a better teacher is to get to know deeply at least one approach to learning and work from that deep knowledge. But there was so much more wisdom from Professor Hollins in the course of the interview. Here are some quotes that stood out for me. She said that every teacher, whether they do it intentionally or not, influences children's perception, their relationships, their values, and who they become. That just shows how responsible the position of teaching is. Professor Hollins noted that a teacher's role is to help every child find a place of comfort in the school, learn to build relationships with peers, and help peers become more accepting of difference. I mean, these are the soft skills of teaching, but they're not at all trivial. They are just so important, and I think it's really good that Professor Hollins highlighted that. One of her mentors advised her that every contact we have, every individual we're talking with, all of that is political. She believes that schools are about the development of the mind, the family, the society, but it begins with the development of the mind and cognition. And she said that an educated person is someone who understands the limit of their own knowledge. If there's something that stood out for you in the interview, please let me know in a comment on the podcast or on Twitter. I want to thank Professor Etta Hollins from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, for her time in recording this podcast. She delayed her return home following the conference in order to do it. If you want to find out more about the work of Etta Hollins, several of her papers are available online by open access, and her books are also worth checking out. That brings us to the end of this Inside Education podcast. You can listen back to more than 420 previous episodes by going to my website, seandelaney.com, and clicking on the podcasts tab. Follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at InsideEd, and write to me by email with comments or suggestions to insideeducationpodcast@yahoo.com. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you access your podcasts, or just tell other educators about it. My book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, was published by Routledge and is available on Kindle and as an audiobook from Audible and on other audiobook platforms. I look forward to being back with a new podcast soon, and thank you for listening today. Your support is appreciated. Thank you.